Hey there, are you sitting down? Good, because Wayfair's end of season sale is here and you can shop it from your couch. It's Wayfair's Labor Day clearance and it's on now. Right now, you can score up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair, like up to 50% off outdoor furniture and decor, and up to 70% off area rugs, plus amazing doorbuster deals and 24-hour surprise flash deals on Wayfair home finds in every style. And get it all with fast shipping on everything right to your door. From furniture to faucets, this is your last chance of the season to score huge deals at Wayfair. Don't let the final days of summer pass you by without shopping these end-of-season savings. So don't wait. Like summer, these savings won't last. Head to Wayfair.com today to score up to 70% off everything home. Celebrate your holiday weekend with can't-miss savings before they run out. Shop Wayfair's Labor Day clearance now through September 2nd at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
From a meeting at the office to a big first date, there's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every event. But clothes don't make the man. So why stuff your closet with things that only work for some situations? With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting. Their clothing is understated and tells the world that you stay you wherever you go. They craft each piece by combining timeless style and modern performance materials, so you can stay looking good and feeling comfortable from morning to evening. No wardrobe changes required. Browse everything from summer-ready tech linen shorts and anti-odor polos to tailored sweats and crews for a night in. They can outfit you for anything, no matter what's on your agenda for the day. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com, promo code MACK25.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Story number one. I have been a park ranger officer for 8 years now, patrolling the Alabama woods. Routine had turned the silence of the trees into old friends, and the wildlife, foxes, snakes, the odd bear, became background noise. Sure, I'd caught murmurs about strange lights, odd animal cries, sometimes found twisted saplings and symbols carved into bark, but none of it clawed at the inside of my skull the way that night did. The night that refuses to let go. It was late spring, a damp, warm night in early May, when my radio crackled to life in the ranger station at exactly 3:03 a.m. The voice wasn't urgent, just a clipped report of a possible trespasser reported by a hunter staying at a nearby cabin. I knew the cabin. Empty cabins meant prank calls during restless nights, so I didn't expect much. But duty meant I couldn't ignore it. The forest under the weak moon felt both overexposed and hidden at the same time. Each time my boots compressed the dirt, a pungent, rotten scent wafted up. Maybe some dead critter or the swampy ground. My flashlight beam cut thin strips through heavy fog, making the oaks look skeletal and the undergrowth endless. Stillness hung over everything except for a faint, fluttering sound. Leaves, I thought at first. I found the hunter's cabin still locked and empty, so I cut across a narrow game trail to scan Deer Hollow. After 10 minutes, nothing. No footprints, no broken branches. I almost radioed in to scold whoever had made the call, but that's when the beam of my torch slid across something moving, a streak of pale, shivering motion by the tree line. It might have been an animal at first, but there was something human about it, along with the eerie straightness of its posture. My spine prickled as I fought the urge to call out, then did anyway. My voice echoing, flat and brittle. No reply, just that soft, hushing rustle. I swept the light again, but the figure was gone, as if it had never been there. No sound of trampling, not even a small twitch. The air grew oddly cold, and the taste in my mouth turned metallic. A dry, light tap landed on my shoulder, heavy with intent. It yanked me from my freeze, and I wheeled around so quickly my torch spun wild arcs into the woods. Standing a dozen paces away was a man, if man is the right word for things shaped like us. He was too clean, too motionless, wrapped in a threadbare flannel that seemed untouched by insects or time. His face was all wrong, gaunt and sunken, but with skin stretched so tightly it reflected the flashlight's glare. His eyes met mine. They were glassy, almost mirrored, and his mouth moved, as if forming words that made no sound. He smiled or mimicked it, a wide, unnatural stretch, and as his lips parted, things poured from the dark gap. Beetles at first, glinting like tiny black pearls, then millipedes, then centipedes, dozens, maybe hundreds. They dropped, wriggling and iridescent, from his grin, and streamed across the moss towards me in a slick, silent tide. Something primal took over. I broke into a sprint, blindly carving through woods, branches clawing my jacket, splinters digging under fingernails. But the forest kept twisting on itself. I zigzagged, changing direction, but no matter which path I took, I would find myself skidding to a halt where he waited. Sometimes closer, sometimes farther. Always the same blank stare, always the crawling horror unfurling from his teeth. I remember a sickly sweet smell, thick and cloying, pressing down on me until breathing felt like swallowing sap. I remember the bugs, the way their carapaces rattled on fallen leaves, a million clicking legs sounding like a chorus of tiny bones. My mind searched for sanity, and still my body screamed at me to run, to claw away from the dark under the trees. At some point, as the man stared at me, cocking his head as if amused, the shapes of the branches bent behind him, knitting into crooked angles. They looked vaguely like hands or antlers or a circle of broken ribs. Lightheaded, vision narrowing, I crashed through a tangle of poison ivy, and then everything choked to black. When I woke up, I was lying face down in pine needles. Sunlight poked through the thick canopy, impossibly ordinary. Ants, beetles, and pill bugs were all over my fingers, in my hair, crawling across my lips. I rolled away from them, heart thudding, and spat and wiped at my skin until it stung. My mouth tasted of old metal and earth. My hands were red with angry welts. There were no unusual footprints except my own from panic sprinting. The air was wrong, stale, heavy, shot through with that same sick sweetness, though it faded as the sun climbed. Limbs shook as I made my way back to the station, checking behind every tree for a flicker of movement or another hateful grin. Inside, the world had snapped back to normal. I combed the logbooks, double-checked the call log, and even asked around if there'd been a report from the cabin. My colleagues laughed, told me the phones were dead past midnight, and the only thing patrolling last night was a possum rooting through the garbage. My call log was clean. Number 3 AM report. Even the cabin's records showed it had been empty for weeks. No explanation stuck. I tell myself fatigue might have spun a nightmare out of an uneventful patrol. Sometimes I try to believe it was all a dream, the mind warping dark shapes into monsters when the woods are deep and the night is thick. But I still walk by Deer Hollow most mornings, still find myself glancing sideways, searching for that impossible smile, the wave of crawling, silent bugs. The scent of sweetness will return now and then, sudden and sourceless, coiling up in my nose. Logical explanations fade when I remember the feeling, the overwhelming certainty of something watching from the shadows, waiting for the night when the radio will buzz faint and early, and this time I won't be able to run at all. The woods, as ever, are still, but I do not sleep so easily anymore. And sometimes when the branches rattle, I feel that gentle tap behind me all over again. Story number 2. It was near the middle of October, air and cold winters blowing, and that's when my friend David and I decided to go hunting. The forest was on the very edge of town. Nobody went there if they could help it. It wasn't a place for camping or family trips or even for the curiosity of children. David only agreed because, like me, he had heard rumors that the game there was plentiful, untouched. Some people said it was because the forest heart was rotten with sickness, that you could smell the rot sometimes. I thought people just liked scaring each other. But the moment we parked at the edge of the tree line, a sense of absence pressed right into my face. It wasn't just quiet. It was as if the world there waited with its breath held. David clapped me on the back, told me not to let childish ideas get the better of me. Maybe he was right. We split up, agreeing to meet near the brook in 2 hours. The earth sucked at my boots as I walked, each step so soft it felt almost obscene, like I was treading on something living, something that could wake. The wind itself sounded smothered. All the colors seemed muted, sucked out of the air. Trees grew too close, branches crooked at angles that made me want to twist my own arms away from my sides. I was circling a patch where the ground was darker, sinking lower. I wanted to believe it was just the recent rains, that the land was just a little loamy, but the way my foot disappeared up to the ankle with a wet gulp made my skin crawl. It was then I heard it, a rhythm I couldn't mistake. Not leaves, not wind, not the casual crackle of a rabbit darting. Soft steps at first, as if someone crept barefoot over velvet, brushing low twigs aside. They quickened, deepened, the squelch of two heavy, two wide hooves crushing sodden ground at a speed no animal should move. My hand went to my hunting knife. I crouched behind a bush so thorny my arm stung where it pressed against the trunk. Through the leaves, something glided into view between the trees. It was not an animal. The lower body was unmistakable, a horse's legs, tail switching, fresh mud up to its hocks. Above, the torso was entirely wrong, far too upright, shoulders thrown back, arms long, reaching, the pallor of the chest visible through gaps in its tangled mane. The face, no, I'll call it a head, because a face is too familiar, was human, but smeared with the same dark mud. Its eyes glimmered, but there wasn't a hint of welcome. I remembered something about centaurs from old books, stories for children, bedtime tales. The wind shifted. It was suddenly, painfully cold, scraping over my neck. The creature jerked, nostrils flaring, and its head locked on the bush where I hid. Those green glow eyes were animal and human at once. I lifted my rifle and aimed, but my hand shook with every breath. The horse thing moved too fast, a flicker of muscle and mud, a blur that closed the gap between us. Its hands reached out, fingers longer than they should be, knuckles muddy, nails cracked and curling. I heard no sound, just an iron panic as the thing lunged. I felt the brush.
Hey there, are you sitting down? Good, because Wayfair's end of season sale is here and you can shop it from your couch. It's Wayfair's Labor Day clearance and it's on now. Right now, you can score up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair, like up to 50% off outdoor furniture and decor, and up to 70% off area rugs, plus amazing doorbuster deals, and 24-hour surprise flash deals on Wayfair home finds in every style. And get it all with fast shipping on everything right to your door. From furniture to faucets, this is your last chance of the season to score huge deals at Wayfair. Don't let the final days of summer pass you by without shopping these end-of-season savings. So don't wait. Like summer, these savings won't last. Head to Wayfair.com today to score up to 70% off everything home. Celebrate your holiday weekend with can't-miss savings before they run out. Shop Wayfair's Labor Day clearance now through September 2nd at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Or was it a cut across my left arm? A burning line that made my entire side pulse sickly. I tried to stumble away, feet caught in sucking mud, and fumbled for the phone in my jacket. My hands were shaking too hard, my palms slick, but I jabbed at the screen, managed to call David, my voice little more than a cracked whisper. I didn't know if he heard me. There was just roaring behind my ears. Then it was gone, just like that. No rush, no snap of twigs, no hint of movement. The sudden emptiness made my ears ring. I crawled upright, dizzy, knees black with sludge. David arrived soon after, bursting through the brush with questions tumbling out, worry in his eyes as he saw me on my knees in the muck. I told him everything, trying to sound logical, but the way his face twitched, half concern, half disbelief, made me stop. He looked around, lips moving, probably muttering about wild animals and exhaustion. He suggested maybe I slipped and hit my head. But as I got to my feet, something drew my gaze downward. My sleeve was torn where my arm throbbed. Beneath, a set of narrow, deep scratches, raw and red, cut through my skin. David tried to inspect it, but I jerked away. He seemed about to argue, but something in my face made him go silent. That's when I noticed the ground. There, in the place where I'd crouched, were prints pressed deep into the mud. Hoof prints, broad with unfamiliar angle. But those impressions weren't right either. David saw the tracks, grunted, said it must be a wild horse that had wandered too close to the town, muddling through the woods. I wanted to believe that. We limped back to the car in an uneasy silence. David glanced back a few times, probably trying to spot deer, and probably, though he wouldn't admit it, checking over his shoulder just in case. The farther we walked from the trees, the more rational the world felt. By the time we reached the road, the horror had receded. At home, David dismissed everything. Stress, hunger, cold. He had a reason for all of it. The scratch, he said, could just be from a bramble I hadn't noticed, and the prints, some unlucky farmer's stray foal. He laughed it off. I tried to. But at night, lying in my bed, I picture the mud still clinging to my boots, the cold air, the shape in the trees with arms too long for anybody that ever was. Maybe David was right. Maybe I panicked and my mind played ugly tricks. Sometimes, though, I wake sweating, certain I hear soft hooves in the empty yard, breathing quietly, waiting. And when I touch my arm, the scratch is still raised and raw. I think of green eyes in the darkness. And I wonder if logic is just another man's comfort when the world outside stops making sense. Story number three. I've been counting birds for 20-odd years, and if you do it season after season, you learn to tune your senses to small changes in the woods. First frost, early migrants, rain freshened air. That's why what happened in June stuck with me. The thunderstorm that night was bad, enough to wake me at 2 a.m, old house creaking, hail ticking off the gutters, a wall of rain washing out all sound. I'd planned my usual early patrol for the ongoing wildlife tracking survey anyway, so come 6 a.m., I laced my boots and set out to the same patch of woods I've walked 1,000 times. Usually the woods pulse with sound at dawn, the trill of warblers, the messy laughter of crows. Instead, silence greeted me. My first reaction was practical. Maybe the storm had shocked everything quiet, or a predator was lurking. Still, it was odd. No flutter, no crack of wings, not a single song. Thick leaves brushed against my arms as I made my way down the tan trail, mud sucking at my boots. The humidity was pressing, heavy and metallic, almost close enough to be tasted. The silence was total, pressing on my eardrums, dissolving the normal soundscape behind a strange ringing. For a moment, I wondered if something was wrong with my own hearing. About 20 minutes down the trail, in a cluster of low brush, I found the first bird, a tufted titmouse crumpled and still. I bent closer. The body looked pristine, not predated or battered. Scanning out from there, I began to spot others. A chickadee, a sparrow, 5, 8, 10 little bodies in all, half buried in the wet loam. All facing the same direction, each head canted up and forward, like a row of spectators caught in surprise. I looked for obvious clues. No wounds, no signs of poisoning around the beaks, a scattered set of heavier prints nearby in the soft mud. A fox, maybe, judging by the size. But even those seemed only to skirt the scene, as if whatever happened here had already happened before the animal arrived. I'm no stranger to death in the wild, but something was off about this. The neat orientation of the bodies, a line, all peering up to a point beyond the trees, the lack of violence or scattered feathers. I checked the canopy above, expecting to see a raptor nest, perhaps some overlooked threat, but there was nothing. The sky glared down, gray and raw from the storm. I ran tests in my head. Was it pesticides from nearby fields, run off into a puddle where they might have drunk? But the leaves and grass showed no chemical residue, no unusual smell. Could it be lightning? There was no charring, no scorched branches. Back home, I decided to check the field camera I'd set up the week before, pointing over that exact patch. I booted up my laptop and felt the familiar stab of tension as the images flickered past. For hours, the woods played out, shadows shifting, squirrel tails flicking, a blur of wings across the lens. Then, 10 minutes before first light, every bird suddenly leaves the frame, a silent exodus, some leap, some drop from branches. And then the camera catches nothing but shivering foliage, empty branches, and silence. It all stopped at once. Even the fox, if that's what it was, didn't appear until an hour later. I reported the incident. They wrote it off with possible explanations. Perfectly logical, if a little too convenient. Still, no one else seemed worried. Days passed, then a week. I tried to rationalize, birds are sensitive. Maybe the low pressure confused them, or the storm brought toxins. I told myself I'd been up too early and let my imagination run wild. But when I returned for my next count, the ringing began again as soon as I reached that same patch, a high, quiet eel of sound sliding under my skull. I forced myself to sit on a fallen trunk and wait for a bird. Any bird. The minutes grew sticky, uncomfortable. Sweat itched behind my knees. Nothing moved. The wind refused to blow. Not even a fly buzzed over the empty spot where I'd found the bird bodies. Some other details have stayed with me. There are spots, even outside the clearing, where the birds still seem to avoid the branches. The undergrowth there grows a little thicker. I keep revisiting other explanations. But then I remember the image of those tiny bodies, aligned so perfectly, facing northwest towards the gnarled black oak, as though they saw something I could not. As summer wore on, the other parts of the woods woke up again. Robins, woodpeckers, a return to normal. But every time I visit that lonely patch, it's all the same. Dead air, the hush so absolute it feels hostile, and always, always the ringing at the edges of hearing. Maybe it really is nothing. Maybe one day the birds will return, and I'll laugh at myself for all these lurching thoughts. But even now, months later, the silence clings to that place, and I can't quite shake the unease that something that had no right to be there, has passed through that patch of forest, and that the birds had been trying to watch it all together just before it was too late. Story number 4. My job as a seasonal forest ranger isn't glamorous, but it's peaceful most of the time. It's been 11 years now, hiking the same trails, carrying a radio, reminding kids to douse their coals, and nudging lost hikers back to gravel paths. I walk these woods enough to feel every subtle shift in the air, every broken branch. In late autumn, when the days begin to shrink, I find the encroaching darkness oddly comforting. I have always trusted what daylight reveals and what dusk hides. I still don't know why my mind circles back to that night, even though I could give you half a dozen logical explanations. I know most would take them and run. They'd rather believe in exhaustion. But I know my own senses. What I saw was as real as the metal of my flashlight, the dried blood on my knuckles from brushing thorn branches. This happened during my last sweep of the evening as the campgrounds emptied for the weekend. I'd chosen the southern loop, where the creek bed passes through layers of old pine needles and bottle green moss. I could walk that distance blindfolded, and maybe that made me careless, cutting through tangles and planning my grocery list in my head. I'd glanced at my watch, barely enough time to make it to the old fire road before the forest swallowed the sun. That's when I realized the path was wrong. I wasn't lost, not exactly, but the dip of the ground was off, flattened out into a basin. Something felt strange in my ears, like the pressure in a car at high altitude, or a mild buzzing, an intrusive silence. I stepped through a thicket, and there it was, a small, perfectly round lake, unnaturally still. The water was black and glassy, smooth enough to make me pause and watch my own reflection obscure the soft, cloud-rimmed sky. There shouldn't have been a lake, not there, only stones, weeds, and the shallow trickle of the creek. I didn't see any sign of runoff or a break in the bank. Nothing. The dead grass at the edge ran right up to the water in a sharp, dry line. No soft mud, no insect hum, no tracks, not a single stick fallen into the lake. It was as if the lake had been drawn with precision, set where nothing had been before. I waited for common sense to click in, but every instinct screamed that something was unnaturally off. I pressed further, circling the water's edge, watching it mirror the roiling purple clouds above. I could hear my own breathing, louder than ever, and not a bird or distant owl interrupted. I wanted to test the surface with a stone, but all around me the earth was bone dry. No pebbles, no leaves, just brittle wheat-brown grass ceasing in a perfect ring. It was then I noticed her. At first, just a pale tangle on the water, long black hair fanned around a slack face, gray-blue skin mottled by the fading light. She was floating, back up, arms out, as still as a corpse. If the water was a mirror, she was the one flaw, a white, sodden figure adrift and unmoving. My first flash of thought was of rescue, of running to help. But there was no splash of movement, no gentle bobbing. She floated unnaturally, like she'd been that way for years. I forced my voice to call out, but the words seemed to vanish into the tree line, swallowed by the growing dusk. Cold settled onto my skin. I could see the girl's lips slightly parted, the hollows beneath her cheekbones almost blue. The sockets of her eyes were dark, too deep, like the water itself. Then the sensation hit me, that unmistakable pulse of proximity. Someone rushing up fast behind me. My heartbeat crashed into my throat. I spun, adrenaline palming my senses raw, convinced someone was there, laughing, about to pull a prank. But the trees behind me were empty of all but shadow and wind. Through the edge of my vision, something flickered, a flash of black hair, pale limbs disappearing behind a trunk, as if the same girl was sprinting towards the woods. My knees nearly buckled. I whipped back to the lake. She was still there, floating motionless, lifeless. The corners of her mouth gone slack now, as if molding into a grotesque smile. I felt sick. The stench hit me next, subtle but invasive. Not the crisp algae scent of an undisturbed lake, but a sharp, sour rot, like wet rags left in a plastic bag, and something that made me gag. My skin crawled with goose flesh. A layer of cold laced my arms. Every instinct told me to run, but I stood frozen. I forced myself to back away, counting shoe scuffs in the dead grass, each footfall echoing. I nearly broke into a jog before dusk could fully set in behind the hills. When I reached the old footbridge, I tried to convince myself of any reasoning that was possible. That night I could not sleep, convinced I'd hear water dripping in the hallway, refrigerator hum sounding like the wine from the lake. When dawn finally broke, I marched back to the same spot, daylight blazing, self-assured that I would find some evidence, anything of a lake, or a misplaced body, or even disturbed soil. There was nothing. Only dry grass, a shallow creek bed, rocks dull and gray, yellow weeds curled back in the wind. No indent to suggest water had ever stood there. No trace of prints, not even a flattened ground where I'd circled the night before. It was as if I'd dreamed it, every detail flickering and false, except I could still smell that watery rot when I shut my eyes, taste it on my breath. My hands stung with cold. I was more alert than ever. Perhaps I was overworked or mistaken. Maybe fatigue warps things or the dusk plays games, painting lakes where only shadows curl. But there's a part of me that lingers by the waterline, watching the surface. Waiting for ripples for a pale face to break through again, pooling quietly in the place where there's never been a lake. Even now the image lingers, a flawless mirror, and a silent, pale figure, half remembered and wholly out of place, floating in the places I thought I knew best. Story number 5. I never considered myself the superstitious type. I didn't grow up on campfire stories or read much about the strange things people say happen out in the woods. I'm a straightforward man, making my living by practical means, hunting, selling pelts, patching up old fences for neighbors out past the ridge. It was a poor season, barely saw a tail all week, and that Sunday dusk found me trudging home, empty-handed along the game trail. It had rained the night before, so the leaf litter was wet, every step sucking quietly at my boots. The sun dipped under the trees, sending sharp shadows clinging to the gullies. I was less than an hour from my truck when I heard the cry. At first, I thought I'd imagined it, a warble of wind maybe. Then it came again, high-pitched, desperate, like a child somewhere, just out of sight, bawling so hard it couldn't catch a breath. Instinct took over, and I called out, trying to sound steady, but the sound only shuddered deeper into the brush, receding, then swelling as if drawing me on. I told myself later that maybe it was a fox. Sometimes their screams can chill your blood. But this was different. It never faded with distance. Instead, it darted just ahead, growing sharper among the hickory limbs and blackberry brambles, always just around the next bend. Branches slapped my arms and I shoved through the underbrush, snagging my jacket, thorns scratching at my wrists. The ground turned black with rot and rain, leaching water from old buried leaves. My heart hammered and I didn't know why. A cold sweat crawling over me. The sound drew me up, pulsing from somewhere ahead, oddly muffled. It was almost as if the world was holding its breath. Even the birds were silent. Then I saw the tree. It reared out of the earth, massive, old, its broad trunk split near the base by some ancient lightning strike. The bark dangled in ribbons, charred and flaking, and its branches stretched toward the sky like clutching hands. The wailing was inside it, clear, unyielding, pouring from the jagged hollow where the heartwood had burned away. I stepped closer and nearly fell. My boot slid across something slick. The failing light revealed a glistening puddle spreading from the hollow, as red as fresh paint. I froze, bile burning at my throat. The smell was overwhelming now, a stench heavy and sweet, coating my tongue and pinching my nose so hard I almost gagged. I shot my flashlight into the yawning gap. The beam caught deep grooves torn down the trunk, vicious slashes through the black char, as if something with fingers or claws had raked them again and again, desperate to get either in or out. Around the roots, a litter of old bones, some snapped through at the joint, some still capped with hunks of fur or sinew dried to the point of translucence. No birds, no scavenger tracks, just those empty sockets all turned toward the hollow. The wailing didn't echo. It filled the trunk like a tongue of cold air trapped under the earth. I circled slowly, keeping my distance, yet the sound didn't drift. It didn't fade or warp with movement. Instead, it seemed to know where I stood and pressed itself against my eardrums, intimate and impossible. For a minute, maybe less, maybe more, I thought about peering into the hollow, shining the light until I saw whatever hunched inside. But I hesitated, powerless against something that defied easy explanation or bravado. Without warning, the wailing stopped. The silence was instant and complete. I blinked, dizzy with relief, or was it dread? Instinct demanded I run because every hair on my arms prickled up and I could feel something staring from that crevice. Not with hope, but with hunger or hate. I pressed my palm to the blackened bark just to convince myself it was real wood, real world, not some trick of failing light or my own imagination. The tree was cold, not cool like bark gets after sundown, but cold as frozen metal, numbing under my glove. And under my fingers, it seemed to pulse, sparks or some kind of tremor, just beneath the surface. I jerked away, staggered back, and scrambled up the incline toward daylight, heart hammering so loud it erased all memory of the sound that had brought me there. I made it home before night shrank the woods into deeper black. My hands shook as I undressed. I told myself the story over and over. Must have been an animal, some trick of the acoustics, bad light, nerves, wind. The blood was probably just a wounded deer, the noise nothing but storm-damaged timber keening under stress. Each explanation made less sense the more I repeated it, but I clung to them all the same. That was 3 weeks ago. I haven't been back. I avoid that stretch of woods, even refusing the neighbor's request to patch their fence past the dry creek bed. Sleep hasn't come easy either. Every night the dream returns. I'm back at the tree, only now I'm lying in that wet pool, the blood creeping up my side, soaking my shirt, my face pressed against the cold, shivering wood. Above me, the hollow opens wider, ready to swallow me whole. Sometimes I wake with a shout, twisted out of the sheets, cold sweat sopping my brow. The rational part of me still insists on reasons. Stress, leftover adrenaline, that sour woodland stink embedded in my jacket fibers. Must be all it is. But sometimes when the wind's just right outside my window, I hear the cry again, impossibly close. It rises and falls just like that night, threaded through with something hollow and mournful. The darkness pools behind my eyelids. I tell myself again and again, it's only the wind in the trees. And I try hard every time to believe it. Story number 6. I'd been working nights at the Backbone Overlook for most of the year. Moonlit bear crossings, meteor showers with the distant hum of the radio, intercoms crackling static as my only companion. The place was older than most of the maps, perched up above the endless folds of fur that broke against the cliffs. My routine kept me sane. quiet check-ins, hot coffee poured from a thermos, heavy boots propped on the antique railing. Nights there were uneventful by design, unless someone got lost or a storm threatened the ridge. That night, around 3 a.m, the air was thick. No wind, not a slice of moon, just the black canopy eating the world outside my lamp's glow. Routine should have felt comforting, but something coiled tight in my gut. Some animal sense I'd learned not to ignore. When I glanced up from my ledgers and swept my beam past the tree line, I spotted a wavering orange spot, a campfire flickering maybe a half mile off trail, just above the swaying black-green sawtooth of spruce. Kids, probably. Backpackers ignoring the rules. Maybe someone lost, or drunk, or trying to catch a thrill deeper into the woods. But the forest floor was as dry as old rope. One spark in the wrong place could turn the whole slope into an inferno. I muttered a curse, grabbed the radio and a flashlight, and set off up the switchbacks. The walk was harder than usual, my breath scraping raw from the cold. As I climbed, the air felt wrong, an old metallic tang, as if the wind itself was burnt. I tried to keep my mind practical. Maybe it was just the scent of smoked pine from their fire. My boots crushed dead needles. My beam flicked over moss and rocks, painting weird shadows on every trunk. I reached the spot in less than 20 minutes. The fire was out, but the embers held their heat, dull orange, rimmed by a rough circle of stones. Two battered tin mugs, each encrusted with black at the lips, sat on the ground. A battered coil of rope, heavy hemp, sun-bleached and nearly frayed through, looped between them, as if someone had just dropped their gear mid-task. But the gear was all wrong. The mugs, the rope, even the stones in the fire ring looked older than me, mismatched, worn by weather or careless years. Each mug was stamped with a faded logo from a long-defunct brand. An old earthy stink hung over everything, clinging to my clothes even after I stepped back from the ring. Convincing myself this was a prank or some careless hiker, I peered around for tracks. There were footprints, big, boot-shaped, wide-soled, heading out deeper into the forest. The prints pressed firm into the dirt, too deep for children. I followed them for 15, maybe 20 yards, my heart galloping double time with every step. The flashlight flickered, picking up the whites of tiny mushrooms, the glint of quartz in a crack. The tracks led straight to a pile of pale, flat rocks stacked waist-high, as if a cairn had been knocked over and rebuilt in a hurry. There, the prints simply ended. No scuff, no false step, no turning away. One last mark, toes pointed square at the pile, then nothing more. I poked about, called out, my own breath shuddering between the trunks, my voice thin and rough. The radio felt useless, but I tried anyway. Static, then my own pulse echoing as no one replied. I walked in circles around the rocks, sweeping my beam through the brambles and catching my own shadow skittering up tree trunks. The forest was smothered in silence. Even the night insects seemed to know to keep still. For a while, I stopped thinking about fire or hikers or rules. My memory of that half hour is strange, round and soft-edged, as if I was stuck in a waking dream. I recall leaving messages on the radio over and over, my words growing slower, as if the air thickened with every syllable. The cold burrowed deep in my knuckles. The edges of my vision wobbled, blurry and gray. When I checked my watch, it showed 6:13 a.m. Dawn should have been spilling through the trees, but the sky was still starless black, the outlines of branches sharp against emptiness. The world seemed stuck, like a reel paused on a forgotten frame. My mind raced. Had I wandered further off trail, lost my sense of direction, misread my watch? Or worse, had the whole thing slipped between the cracks of sleep? I hiked back toward the overlook, nerves brittle, flashlight jumping over the shapes that might have been logs or might have been huddled figures staring from the gloom. My mouth was filled with the sick taste of copper and smoked tin. Every so often the air would shift, and the scent of burnt rope, dusty metal, would grow so sharp I had to swallow hard, fighting the urge to gag. When I reached the outpost, the world seemed to snap back to normal. The trees rustled. The sky lightened, as if dawn had waited for me to unlock it. The radio crackled out a weather update, as if nothing had happened. My logs showed nothing unusual, I couldn't sleep the next day. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw that fire ring, the old rope coiled beside the mugs, the boot prints that started one place and ended at a cairn, as if the forest had swallowed their maker. The following night, against my better judgment, I hiked up to that spot again. My feet found the route without any trouble. The patch of wood where I'd knelt by the embers looked untouched. No fire ring, no mugs, no rope, not a single blade of grass turned. I pressed my hand to the ground, not even a hint of ash, no disruption of dirt. The forest swallowed its secrets in silence. Now, whenever someone mentions the smell of burnt metal or insists that the woods don't remember, I keep my mouth shut. When I wake up from restless sleep with the tang of old rope drying my throat, I run my fingers over the logbook, tracing the hours that vanished like heat from a phantom fire, wondering if those lost tracks will ever reappear in daylight. For all I know, I never left the Overlook at all, or maybe I never really made it back. Story number 7. I pulled into the logging road just before dawn, my boots crunching frost when I stepped out. The mountains loomed silent. Even the pines seemed subdued that morning, shrouded in a haze of fog, branches pressing in heavy and solemn. I'd been hunting here plenty, but this time, I wanted to see where the game trail that ran behind the ridge actually went. In all my years, I'd never properly followed it. Early archery season, and I told myself it was luckier to go off the main draw, cut through fresh, soft mud where the deer prints ran deep and straight. The trail was clear, too clear. Large splayed prints ran ahead, veering up into thicker brush that looked undisturbed. My boots left neat marks as I went. I made a habit of leaving orange flagging tape behind, tying a strip every 50 yards. The forest just felt thick, clogged with something the morning sun couldn't quite break apart. Birds didn't call, no wind creaked the branches. My own breathing and the sucking noise of my boots were the only sounds. Soon things stopped adding up, though nothing was quite out of place. Every so often, maybe a bowshot's distance, the trail twisted oddly, and I'd swear I passed the same three-armed cedar or the stump pocked with old bullet holes. Yet each time I was sure of it, something would be off. The cedar's scars would be mirror reversed, or the stump had a wet fungal bloom spread like a black hand. I pressed on, heart beating faster, sweat itching beneath my undershirt, though the air remained cold. Where I'd tied orange ribbons, I'd turned to see them missing. One time a strip was there, a crumbling, faded thing, hanging sun-bleached and brittle, ancient compared to the roll in my pocket. I tried to shake off the dread. Maybe local hikers had used the same trail years ago. Maybe my sense of direction was off. Good forest could confuse anyone. The ground was muddy, but I never crossed my own tracks, never saw any sign of backtracking or confusion. Just those prints moving ahead, somehow always just further out, impossibly crisp. My GPS, so reliable elsewhere, began flickering. Altitude numbers spun crazily. The compass wobbled, then just blinked zeros. The light up there didn't track right. I told myself it must be clouds hiding the sun, but the trails became shaded in places they shouldn't. Sometimes it seemed like the fog brightened out of nowhere, bleaching everything. And at the bends, the dirt would darken, sucking up light so the ferns glistened, sickly and black. An hour must have passed. My body ached in the way that comes with walking uphill too long, but my mind wouldn't shake the sense that time had stalled. I checked my watch. The hands ticked, but every time I looked again, the minute hand was back where it started. Each time I paused to rest, I kept feeling behind me. Felt watched, scrutinized by something just out of sight, but surely near. Yet turning quick, clutching my bow, there was nothing but emptiness. No birds, no squirrels. Just the oppressive space between trees. 100 times I reasoned through it. Maybe the trail cut a wide circle. Maybe something about the cloud cover explained the light. Maybe the GPS just lost satellites. Simple. My brain repeated these explanations, as if saying them over and over repelled the growing tangle in my gut. I stopped when a familiar set of branches snapped across the path. Deadfall, I thought I'd passed an hour before. But here, they were both the same and not, slick with a resin I didn't recognize, shining with wetness as though freshly snapped. The smell was sharp and wrong, bitter, like hot electronics, and mold blended in humid rot. I couldn't convince myself that was normal sap. That's when I noticed my markers were altogether gone. I even checked the tree I was sure I'd flagged. The bark had been gouged, pocked deep as if by animal claws. And where tape should have been, something hung instead. An old bit of red cloth, soaked into green bark, looking more like dried bloodstain than flagging. The next 10 minutes stretched. I stopped seeing prints. The mud where I expected to find fresh tracks was churned, but with nothing I recognized, marks too large, toes too long. My own boot print, clear before, was swallowed, vanished, erased as if I floated. I turned circles looking for any landmark, and every view was subtly rearranged. Trees too close where the path had seemed broad before, sky blotted to a pinprick. I could not tell where I'd come from or where I'd go. Still, I pressed forward along the vague trail, steps growing frantic. A prickling weight crept up my back and scalp, a consciousness behind the silence so intense it was like a physical presence. The taste of iron was in the air, and my every nerve felt raw and peeled. Then, without warning, crack. Something snapped just behind me, sharp as a shotgun, and I spun, arrow knocked, panic emptying everything in me. For just a second, I felt whiplashed, vision swimming, and inexplicably, there was my truck. No transition, no trail leading back. Just open gravel, the forest behind me denser than I remembered, and my breath billowing in cold, early morning air. I nearly fell from shock. The truck was parked wrong, turned 90 degrees from how I'd left it. The driver's side dusted in frost I hadn't seen before. There weren't even old footprints where I should have come out. I checked around, trembling, and there were no tracks, none from me, none from animals, just a flat churn of stones and grass. The trail I'd followed was gone, replaced by unbroken bramble, thick moss, and no sign of my markers. Sitting in the driver's seat, the clock glared an impossible time. 6 minutes passed when I'd first entered the woods. When I sat, a shudder ran through me, too deep to explain. Jaw clenched, I started the engine. By the time I hit the highway, the world outside looked harmless, normal. Sun climbing above the hills, crows squabbling along the shoulder. The only proof anything had happened was the bit of red, sodden tape still stuck to my jacket, knotted tight as a tourniquet. Sometimes I try to convince myself. Fog, panic, trick of the light, a sleepy mind and unreliable tech. But every so often, usually deep in the night, the memory returns. How the silence stretched, the feeling of being weighted down by unseen eyes. The way the same trail shifted underfoot, how my markers aged to rot in seconds. The forest is old. It doesn't need excuses. I don't hunt that ridge now, and even the wind there feels sour. I tell myself I dodged a trick of the mind, but I won't walk it again. Story number 8. I'd been camping alone since I was a teenager, mostly out of thrift and a stubborn love for quiet. The world changes deep in the woods, especially after rain, when the earth exhales mist and the air carries a sharp tang of decay and shoots. My spot was remote, a sloping shoulder above a small creek, northern hardwoods hunched in gloomy, close silence. That spring, the weather was fickle and drenching. My old green tent with its faded canvas and leaky seams was my only shelter. On the third night, I drifted off, listening to water tapping the fly, the soft plink of droplets into puddles. Something woke me just after midnight. I'd like to blame the wind, but the gusts had died down earlier, leaving a damp hush. I lay cocooned in my sleeping bag, staring upward into dense dark. And then I felt it, a weight against the fabric above my face, a palm unmistakably human in motion and pressure, pressed down the thin canvas. The cold from it bled straight through to my cheekbones, sharp and stinging. My heart lurched into my throat and stayed there, clogging my breath. It stayed there, fingers spread as if feeling for bone through cloth. I could feel the slow, shifting pressure of weight. Each digit outlined in cruel chill, the pads calloused, rough, nothing like my own soft hands. None of the easy warmth of another living person. In the awful hush that followed, the hand began to move. With a dragging, scraping sound that made the hair stand up on the back of my neck, it slid down and sideways, as if tracing the seams or reading the taut canvas. The faint friction sang like paper against wood, a noise that needed no explanation. No animal could replicate. I lay paralyzed, squeezed in terror with only a thin wall between me and whatever was outside. The hand withdrew, slow and deliberate, and the silence closed in so thick I could hear rainwater drip from needles onto the nylon fly. I lay there for minutes, or maybe hours, ears straining for footsteps, crackles, any clue. But nothing followed, not so much as the snap of a twig. I did not move until dawn began washing color into the sky, feeble but enough to chase the blackness back. Then I unzipped the tent, the metal teeth loud as gunshots, and fought my way out under low branches. The mud outside was undisturbed. No prints, no gouges, not even the boot-shaped hollows I'd left the previous night. The only mark was where the rain had gathered and the moss soaked it up. But above my makeshift pillow, bold as anything, was the handprint. Even through the muck and days of drizzle, I could make out where the fingers had pressed in. It was nearly twice the size of my own. The fabric sagged where the palm had weighed it down, the outline almost too symmetrical. The print should have vanished in the rain or under my fingers as I rubbed at it, but it remained, a faint, oily shadow, almost imperceptible in some lights, but always clearer after dusk when the air turned colder. For breakfast, I tried to rationalize. Maybe a wave of cold had woken me from a dream. The roughness could have been the tent shifting in the wind, the scraping nothing but brambles dragged over the canvas by the morning breeze. The print, maybe a residue from my hand, distorted by water, smeared into weird size and shape. But every time I reached up, palm to canvas, the memory of that pressure came back, an echo on my skin, impossible to scrub away. It snowed the following night, fierce for spring. The tent should have been soaked anew, wiped clean like a chalkboard, but the outline was still there in the morning, darkening, if anything, deepening into the weave like a bruise. I abandoned the last day's hunting, packed up camp, and slung the tent over my shoulder. I couldn't bring myself to sleep in it again. Back home, friends heard my story and laughed it off. Some suspected a bored poacher or a local kid playing tricks. Never mind that the odds of someone hiking miles off the trail through bramble and muck in the dead of night, just for a prank that left no trace, seemed outright strange. Others said the fabric was probably stained already, and my mind had found shapes in the chaos. But for weeks, the tent held that giant handprint. I locked it in the shed. Even when I took it out to wash, it remained. Part oily shadow, part memory, never fully disappearing in daylight, always looming just on the edge of dusk. No matter how I explained it in my head, wind, water, fatigue, the tricks of a half-awake mind, the sensation of that hand pressing downward was always there at night, just above my face, cold and weighty as regret. I found another campsite, closer to people, within earshot of cars and their familiar noises. But I never quite lost the expectation that, in the blackest hour before dawn, someone or something would trace the seams of my new shelter, seeking out the weak points, cold fingers leaving marks behind. In the end, there's only the sense of unease. The handprint, like a bruise in the fabric, outlasted reason. Some things, I suppose, settle in the dark and remain, waiting for silence and rain and someone foolish enough to listen.